It has been a week, I will tell you what. The Fed on Wednesday, Jobs Day Friday. Where, oh, where should we begin? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 3rd of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I think what we're going to do, actually, is do this in reverse chronological order, which means this morning's announcement of April unemployment is where we start. 263,000 new jobs added to this economy last month. The unemployment rate fell to 3.6%, a generational low, it has to be pointed out. Anna Swanson is at the New York Times. Kate Davidson is with the Wall Street Journal, here to fully contextualize the past 5 days in this economy. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Kate, let me start with you and this. Every time, and certainly we've said it here, but every time the jobs report has come out in the last, God, it's got to be like a year, we have said, oh, we're at full employment. This can't possibly go on any longer. And yet, every month, it keeps going on. What gives?
It's amazing.
I know.
Well, I think that it's a sign of a couple things. One seems to be that there are just more people out there. The economy, because it's so strong right now, is continuing to draw workers off of the sidelines. Now, this month's report showed perhaps a little bit of a dip. The participation rate went down for the second straight month. But more broadly, as you said, over the past year or so, that rate has been doing well. And I think that we've been hearing from employers that they're having a hard time finding workers, and that low unemployment rate means, would suggest, as you said, that there just aren't that many more people, but they're coming in. So they're being attracted by a couple things. I think wage gains have been much stronger, up 3.2%. in April from a year earlier. So, it was a pretty strong report.
So, Anna, let me ask you this, and this is a large contextual question, but it does seem to have been a 5 or 6 day period of conundrum in this economy, right? We got gross domestic product last week at 3.2%. We got jobs today, really nice. Inflation came out on Monday, Tuesday. It was really low. The Fed's hanging on. There's something unusual happening, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. So this combination of super low unemployment and high growth and low inflation is not really supposed to be possible. Yeah. So when unemployment drops this low, job creation should slow and inflation should surge. But we're just seeing the economy keep on trucking. And, the Fed, it's kind of a bizarre situation for the Fed, where softening inflation and strong job growth are pointing them in two different directions. So this week, the Fed said it was expected above trend growth to support inflation over time. And they indicated that they're on hold for now. They're basically on pause to see what shakes out in this economy.
So, Kate, to that point of Jay Powell and the Fed and them, in essence, and I'm going to exaggerate here a little bit, but in essence, they're just kind of shrugging their shoulders and saying, we're guessing that inflation's going to bounce back to where we want to be, around 2%. But they don't really know.
A little bit, yeah. It's reminding me of this really funny speech from, I think it was Randy Quarles, the Fed vice chairman last year, where he talked about his training as a
those funny Fed speeches.
but he trained as a pilot, and he talked about how when he was starting out in flight school, they trained them not to focus too much on the needle, right, where the dial is showing them. But they had to kind of learn to follow all of the signs and not target one direction too closely in particular. And he kind of said this is sort of where what we as officials feel like we need to do right now.
Right.
And so instead of raising rates preemptively because job growth is strong and they expect it to lead to more inflation, they're sort of switching their mode. And now they've gone from that to this kind of wait and see mode. And I think that that they signaled on Wednesday that they're pretty confident that that's working right now because of this positive data. And that was reaffirmed, of course, with Friday's jobs data.
Yeah, let me take a very quick swing into the politicization of the Fed, Anna, and then we'll move off the central bank. Stephen Moore, the president's floated nominee, but not officially named to the Fed board guy, has withdrawn. Larry Kudlow said today, the president's chief economic advisor, the vice president of the United States, also said today that what they want the Fed to do is actually cut rates right now. Give me like 30 seconds on politicization of the Fed. And maybe has this episode of Mr. Kane and Mr. Moore taught the president anything?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I don't necessarily think so, because in a tweet earlier this week, the president actually compared the Fed to China and said, yes, China is adding great stimulus to its economy while at the same time keeping interest rates low. I mean, you know, the Federal Reserve is supposed to be, it operates independently from the White House, that's pretty different from China's managed economy. I think it's worth remembering that this just isn't, this isn't normal. And, you know, we have seen the president's recent efforts to put his supporters on the Fed fail, with Herman Cain and Stephen Moore both withdrawing from consideration. It remains to be seen what kind of candidate they put up next.
Anna, let me stay with you for a second. Since you mentioned China, I do want to draw on your trade expertise, which is your beat at the Times. Secretary Mnuchin and Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer have been in Beijing this week doing what one assumes will be the very hard last few things in a U.S.-China trade deal. What can you tell us?
It does seem like it. The administration is emphasizing that, you know, the president could still walk away. He's ready to do that. But we could see a China deal as early as next week. And, you know, it does seem like it'll leave some of the Trump administration's goals on the cutting room floor, like subsidies, cyber theft, data restrictions. But I think you can also credibly make the argument that President Trump is getting more here from China than past administrations have done. I mean, I think the big question for me is whether we should declare victory here for the more aggressive trade strategy in general. And, you know, what the question is, what comes next? I mean, the China agreement might still be setting us up for more tension between the two countries. If tariffs are brought back into the relationship, you could see a tit-for-tat tariff war kind of follow quickly here to an agreement.
Kate, very quickly to you, sort of riffing off what Anna said there, the Trump administration declaring victory and departing the field. They've pushed the Chinese more than recent administrations have. Should they just say, we got what we wanted and let's move on?
Maybe they should, Guy, but something tells me that that this White House is not going to go that way. So I guess we shall see.
We shall indeed. Kate Davidson at The Wall Street Journal, Anna Swanson at The New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thanks,
thank
Guy.
You.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street this Friday in early May, not so doggone bad. Actually, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. As we were just talking about, Kate and Anna and I, the labor slice of this economy right now is doing pretty well. Wage gains, though, as was alluded to, decent, I would say. Average hourly earnings are growing more strongly than they had been, up 3.2% compared to a year ago. Low unemployment and inflation, as we mentioned, basically dormant, are translating to people having more purchasing power. And workers in some occupations in this economy are doing a good deal better than others. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains what's going on there.
Wages are growing fastest right now for low-skilled and entry-level workers, machine operators, bartenders, truck drivers, cashiers. Partly that's driven by mega employers like Amazon, which announced last fall to its workers,
effective November 1st, we are also establishing a new Amazon minimum wage of $15 an hour.
Scott Waletsky at staffing firm ADECO says other employers have to raise wages to compete with big companies like Amazon, and they're offering valuable perks, too.
Commute money and gas cards and parking vouchers, you know, state-of-the-art cafeterias and large distribution and warehouse facilities.
For years after the Great Recession, there were still a lot of people unemployed and desperate for any low-wage job. But not anymore, says Martha Gimbel at Indeed.com.
A lot of those low-wage jobs are just not that appealing. And so if those industries want to keep their workers or attract new ones, they're going to have to raise their wages to compete.
If employers don't want to pay more for labor, they can try to automate, invest in robotics and artificial intelligence to do the work. But a lot of lower-skilled personal service jobs, like home health aide and bank teller, are actually hard to replace with machines. Andrew Chamberlain is at job site Glassdoor.
They usually have zero bargaining power in the economy, and employers will only pay what they have to. So it's only when employers run out of workers and they're really struggling do they finally raise pay for those people.
And Chamberlain says minimum wage hikes across the country are also helping push wages higher at the bottom of the pay scale. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Not for nothing, but there is a distinct what's in it for me moment to be had here coming out of this morning's jobs report. Mitchell was telling us about wages being on the rise a couple of seconds ago. Anna and Kate were talking about how low the unemployment rate is and how strong labor is. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has a seize the day message for you.
The phrase tight labor market, let me translate that for you. This could be your moment. Comb your hair, shoulders back, and march right into the boss's office or dust off the old resume.
The problem is that workers aren't really used to doing that.
Sylvia Allegretto is a labor economist at UC Berkeley. She says thanks to the long-term decline in labor unions and the lingering effect of the financial crisis, workers are in unfamiliar territory here.
It's hard for workers to understand that maybe they have a little bit of power.
Your first step might be to ask your current company for more money. But workers should be looking, says Harry Holzer at Georgetown University, aggressively and extensively.
The best way to get raises is if you're able to move in the labor market, to sort of voluntarily leave your job.
That cliche about how it's easiest to find a job when you already have one, it's true. Holzer says changing jobs can be especially lucrative for younger workers.
It's early in people's careers where they often get the biggest jumps in salary. It's often a good time for young people to look around, look outside of their own job.
And just how big a difference can it make to change jobs? Susan Lamott runs the HR consulting firm Exaquio.
Right now, employers know that when they hire someone from the outside, they're probably going to pay about a 20% premium to hire that worker away from one employer to come to their organization to do the same job.
Meanwhile, workers who stayed in their jobs last year averaged merit increases of only 2.8%, according to Mercer, an HR consultant. Lamott says if you like your current job, you can try being transparent with your employer before you start looking for a new gig and see if they'll be proactive. Otherwise, practice those interview skills and see what you might be worth elsewhere. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The entertainment calendar is set to turn its attention to New York for the annual extravaganzas that are collectively known as the upfronts, where TV and increasingly digital media trot out their stars and their new shows for advertisers who reciprocate by booking billions of dollars in ad time. The big broadcast networks are up at the upfronts over the next couple of weeks, a ritual that has been going on for 50 years. But much like the media landscape itself, the festivities have pretty much exploded over the past decade. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino checks out the current state of the upfront industrial complex.
Brad Adgate has been going to the upfronts for almost 30 years. He runs his own media consulting firm now, and he remembers the good old days. About a week of glam and glitz with the big broadcast TV networks, photo ops with Morgan Fairchild, and parties at Tavern on the Green.
You'd have jumbo shrimp to, you know, you get sick to your stomach.
But these days, the upfront ad market goes on for nearly 2 months.
It can be a lot of fun, but it's also very tiring. It's a real marathon.
There are the big broadcasters and cable, but also a whole other event called New Fronts for digital content.
Vice, BuzzFeed, Vox, Hulu.
Brian Steinberg is senior TV editor for Variety. He says the scope of the upfronts reflect the increasing number of content producers. And the competition for ad dollars as streaming moves in on traditional media is tight.
You have a lot of different players that are trying to eat at the same pie.
Even Walmart and Target are getting in on the New Fronts game. Walmart has Vudu, an ad-supported video-on-demand service. Garrett Sloan covers tech for Ad Age. He says,
Target did not have any real content play. It's an advertising play.
As in, Target is selling space in its digital ads and on its website to brands. But Variety's Brian Steinberg says the networks still have the advantage because live events like the Super Bowl.
TV still gets the biggest number of people in one fell swoop. They're still kind of the tallest person in the room, even though everyone in the room is shorter.
A fact the networks will surely be looking to highlight as they make their big sales pitches next week. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
coming up.
So they had a very different notion of science, but they wanted the end result, which was power.
China's technology policy, the origin story. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 197 points today, 0.7%, 26,504 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ rose 127 points, 1.5%, 8,163. The S&P 500 up 28 points, 0.9%, 29.45 there. For the week, the Dow gave back 0.1%. The NASDAQ gained 0.2%. The S&P 500 gained about 0.1%. Amazon up 3.2% today on news that Berkshire Hathaway has bought shares in the company for the first time. Walmart stacked up 0.9% after an analyst upgraded the retailer stock. Costco up 0.7%. Target, though, off 0.6%. Also, did you know they had a video play? Consumer goods firm Newell Brands leapt 13.5%. The maker of Rubbermaid containers posted better-than-expected first-quarter profits. The company cited cost savings and higher pricing as well. Procter & Gamble, P&G, rolled up 0.4%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.52%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hi, I'm Molly Wood, and you need to listen to this week's Make Me Smart. This week, we are talking about CRISPR, the gene editing tool that can alter DNA in plants, animals, and yes, humans.
We're talking about, you know, putting the evolution of the human species kind of in our own hands. Those are the stakes.
Make Me Smart. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We were talking China just a little bit up at the top of the program, the trade talks that are grinding on. We're going to do a little historical China word association right now, all right? I say China and high tech. You say world-beating companies like Alibaba or Tencent, right? Or threat, maybe, as in the Chinese surveillance and hacking state. Or unfair, with illegal subsidies and shutting out foreign competition. One way or another, technology is at the heart of how Beijing is going to exercise its power in the global economy. And those are plans that go back a long way. Tomorrow, May the 4th, is the 100th anniversary of a key moment in that history when Chinese leaders decided their country needed to go modern. Marketplace's Scott Tong. Once upon a time, our bureau chief in Shanghai takes us on a very short march.
The Chinese government tends to go big on anniversaries. This week, state TV featured youth singing or lip-syncing in commemoration of an event a century ago.
1919 would be the year that sparked China's renaissance. Thousands of students gathered at the center of Beijing's Tiananmen Square on the afternoon of May the 4th.
To protest. Here's why. World away in France, peace talks to end World War I sold China out, as the protesters saw it. Beijing had hoped to regain control of Chinese territory long occupied by the Germans. But treaty negotiators gave it to Japan. And fury ensued, says Oxford historian Rana Mitter.
When this news got back to Beijing, the students, who young, patriotic, nationalistic, were so angry, so outraged, that they decided that the only thing they could do was to demonstrate.
Protests spread across China, prompting a broader question, why was China so weak, so behind the outside world of railroads, cars, and modern weapons?
They argued that two characters were needed to be brought into China to deal with the problem. One was Mr. Science, and the other one was Mr. Democracy, to completely rethink and retool China.
Mr. Science meant out with Confucius and in with Einstein, Darwin, open debate. And then 3 decades later, Mr. Democracy went quiet. China became a one-party state. Mao Zedong proclaimed the People's Republic in 1949, and Communist China used science to bolster its legitimacy. Cornell physicist Yang Cheng writes about China and science, and she says the propaganda went something like this.
If a party is scientific, and if science is the one and only truth, then a party of science must be the one and only legitimate party.
The government handpicked projects intended to strengthen China. Power plants, weapons, factories.
Disciplines that directly contribute to national defense, such as the nuclear and space programs, were given priority.
She says this techno-nationalism remains today. But there are limits to Chinese science. Orville Schell, China scholar at the Asia Society, says the fields that thrived had to be approved by the government.
but it didn't want to be infected by the idea of sort of enlightenment thinking, that science was a liberating force, that one had to let thinking go wherever it needed to go.
Historically off limits were cosmology and certain social sciences.
So they had a very different notion of science, but they wanted the end result, which was power.
Today, critics say because of this top-down thinking, China unfairly subsidizes its high-tech companies and walls off foreign competition. Still, this model has spawned billion-dollar companies and policies and plans to keep moving forward.
Bringing home Chinese scientists, adopting modern, forward-looking scientific fields like AI, 5G, robotics.
For all its success, historian Rana Mitter wonders if China's limits on debate will, in the end, limit invention.
There are still doubts as to whether a system which does rely on people having to behave in certain political ways is going to provide the space to allow the kind of people who will have those really kind of wild thoughts. Could Steve Jobs have emerged in China?
Proponents of China's science and technology model note that it has often proved doubters wrong. Wherever it goes from here, the Chinese will connect their progress back to May 4th, 1919, when a weak and angry country turned to Mr. Science. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
End today's show the way we started it, with jobs, specifically jobs held by some of the youngest people in this economy. In the unemployment report out this morning was this nugget, that the jobless rate for teenagers is something like 13%. The Labor Department, though, only counts people over the age of 16. So Alina Morse is too young to be included in the jobs report, but she does have a very big job, running a multi-million dollar candy company. She came into our Los Angeles studios the other day with one of her employees.
My name is Alina Morse. I'm 13 years old, and I am the CEO creator of Zollipops.
My name is Tom Morse. I am the manager at Zollipops, and I'm also Alina's dad.
So Zollipops are an all-natural, sugar-free lollipop that actually cleans your teeth. We're also allergen-free, gluten-free, dairy-free, vegan, kosher, keto. You know, we really try and make Zollipops accessible for everyone, and so that everyone can keep smiling.
You know, this idea was really, it started out being, she just wanted to have candy, and she was tired of us probably telling her no. One day we went to the bank, and the teller had offered her a sucker, and she looked up at me and said, "Dad, can I have it? I know it's filled with sugar." And I said, "You know, it's up to you." And
he guilted me into it.
She walked away a little bit unhappy, but then she asked, "You know, Dad, why can't we make a healthy lollipop?"
My initial attempts of making our Zollipops were, let's just say, they weren't very successful.
She made a mess of the kitchen. It was a disaster.
I genuinely severely messed up our stovetop.
I think we had to replace the stove.
And my parents weren't too happy about it.
But she came up with something that was really good, and she never quit.
It's crazy how much we've grown in such little time. I mean, it feels like yesterday that I was pitching to Whole Foods.
So after about 2.5 years of helping Alina just like on a part-time basis, there was just so much opportunity there that I had to leave my day job and focus on it 100% of my time with her. It was quite a decision to make, but the opportunity to work with my daughter, it's probably been one of the most fulfilling things I've ever done in my life.
In most cases, he is the boss because he is my father and I live under his roof. But when it comes to existential decisions in the company, that is when you will come to me.
So it's a little more official now. I've been working for her since she was born, but now it's actually official. I definitely work for her.
Business really is a team sport, and this is just like, it's next level bonding.
Alina Morse there and her dad/employee Tom talking about the company that she runs, Zollipops. final note on the way out today. I saw this the other day, forgot to get it in the show, to be completely honest with you. The Video Game Hall of Fame Awards came out this week. Mortal Kombat, Super Mario Kart, of course. Also, the solitaire game that has been part of the Microsoft operating system since 1990. Honestly, I'd have thought it was in there already. All right, we are out of here. The Dow Industrial is up 197 today, 0.7%. The NASDAQ up 127 points, about 1.5%. S&P 500 up 28 points, 0.9%. For the week, by the way, everything just about flat, which is the first time it seems that that's happened for a week in a good long while. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the Senior Vice President and General Manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.